Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky and disturbing children's books, films and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're talking about the book Moondial by Helen Creswell. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy!
Hi, are you, I can hear you rubbing your hands together. Are you cold?
I'm making some honey fermented cranberries, and I picked up the jar to give them a little scoozle around, and there was honey on the jar because they've been fermenting and expanding outwards. So I have honey on my hands, and that's why I'm rubbing them together.
Well, firstly, I love the fact that you said scoozle.
Thank you.
And secondly, you're quite into your fermentation, aren't you?
This seems to be... This is at least the second time I've mentioned it on the podcast.
So, it seems to be what you're doing with your 30s is fermenting things.
Yeah. I've got into kombucha and kefir and sauerkraut when I can be bothered, but I don't know, grating a whole cabbage is a hassle, to be honest.
I think I'd happily grate a cabbage patch kid. I think that'd be quite satisfying.
Yeah, you make sauerkraut from cabbage patch kids. You just need a cabbage patch kid, salt, filtered water, a jar, and then just leave it for a week or two. And
So listeners, if you do that, please send in your photos.
God, I need to think what you create from a fermenting a cabbage patch kid.
A taste experience.
Are you ready to talk about Moondial?
I am ready to talk about Moondial, but I don't know how, because this is quite a strange, impressionistic book from way back in 1987, the year of my birth.
Ah, oh, yeah, it is. It's by Helen Creswell.
I should use Cress. Well, but that's just because I like cress.
Yeah.
And I like to imagine that the cress is well.
Yeah, don't we all?
Yeah.
Written in 1987, but does have... it does have some specifically 1987 references, but it also sort of feels quite timeless as well. Aside from the references to... cassette players and digital watches, but Helen Creswell, who according to Wikipedia wrote over 100 children's books.
Frickin' heck.
I've spent the last 3 months working on a single 1,000-word short story, so I'm wildly impressed and very intimidated by that feat.
Yeah, no, that's remarkable. and I assume that most of them are not of kind of spot the dog kind of brevity.
Yeah, no, I think they're... I don't think so. I think maybe some of them are picture books, but I think most of them are, you know, books with a certain number of words in them. Judging by Moondial, they're... It's not like they're just like dashed off either. Like, this is a very well written book.
Oh yeah, Moondial It's quite a literary work, I'd say. Like, if I was to describe this book succinctly, I would say impressionistic. Yeah, it's a book of tones and atmosphere and strange in-betweeny feelings and places.
So yeah, it was published in 1987 and then apparently popular enough to be made into a BBC TV series the following year, which
Which
is
is
quite impressive.
remarkable because it's not that easy a read.
It is. I was a bit surprised. Like, it's very good, but it's not. I don't know. I guess it's the visual aspect of it that it's so atmospheric that you can imagine it being, you can imagine the visuals of the TV series and the Moondial looking very good in the mist and that sort of thing. But
I mean,
I
I
don't
don't
know.
know about yours, but my edition was published in association with the National Trust.
All right.
The picture is, I think, a still from the television programme, so I don't know if this is a reprint. So it's got the three characters, well, three child characters, sorry. So it's staring out at the reader with quite hard to place expressions, actually. The boy we'll know as Tom looks slightly. I mean, he does look consumptive, to be fair, which is the right look for him, I guess. Minty has her head sort of cocked to one side and looks like she's kind of questioning the reader. And then there's the other little girl who. What's her name? The little
Sarah.
Sarah. Yeah, and as Sarah looks concerned, basically. And they're posed around the moon dial itself. What about your cover?
I have a quite a lovely illustration by Julia Sada that's it's of the moon dial with the man and the boy with the both winged sort of holding the moon dial and they both have some hollow dark eyes and mournful expressions and behind them is a graveyard with ghosts with similarly hollow eyes poking her heads up from behind the gravestones and then there's a silhouette of a cloaked figure standing in front of the moon dial
So it sounds like your cover really sort of focuses on the horror aspects of the book.
it does yeah
I mean, would. Oh, it's a really tricky question. Would you call this children's horror?
It's a slippery one.
Yeah, I really don't know. I've been thinking about it quite a lot because part of me says, no, this is a book, it's a time travel book on one level, on a literal level, but it's largely about time and loss and reconciling these things and love versus time. And it's got these quite broad existential philosophical themes, and it's a kind of impressionistic, quite dreamlike novel about these, and it doesn't really have outright horror sequences. But then there's part of me that thinks, okay, what would I even compare this to? And I keep thinking, actually, it's quite M.R. James like, to be honest. This seems like really indebted to British ghost stories, and surely, if anything is horror, a ghost story is.
And I mean, I think you can definitely draw parallels with Coraline as well.
Yeah.
Let's see, in the other direction of all the things that I think there's lots of threads of comparisons you can make to things that we've talked about before. So I think there's lots of aspects of children's horror.
Yeah, it's definitely of a piece. I mean, in terms of books we've talked about before, I'd say Mary Ann Dreams, There's some real similarities in terms of the child protagonist and sticking very close to the experiences of a child protagonist and occupying this very uncertain space between waking life and dreaming life. And keeping that open and ambiguous and really not closing it down at all.
Yeah. And I thought the character of Miss Raven was could have come right out of like Wolves of Willoughby Chase kind of.
Yeah.
No, no. I was wondering if you would read the prologue.
I'd be delighted to.
To set the tone.
Okay. It is midnight. In that most dark and secret place, if you should chance, and why should you, to be walking there, you would be blindfolded by the night. You would hear the hooting of a lone owl from the church tower, the scuff of your own steps on the gravel. You would smell the ancient, musty scent of the yews that line the path, and the curious, cold green odour of dew on grass. You put out a hand. It gropes to find the ungiving touch of stone. The shock of it brings an uprush of fear so strong that you can almost taste it. At that moment, your fifth sense is restored. A slow silver light yawns over the garden. Shapes make themselves, statues loom. Ahead, the glass of the orangery gleams like water. You notice the shadow the moon has made at your feet, as you had never noticed a mere daytime shadow. You stand motionless, with all five senses sharp, alert as a fox. But if, by some chance, you should possess another, a sixth sense, what then? First a tingle of the spine, a sudden chill, a shudder. You are standing at a crossroads, looking up at a statue. A huge stone man seems locked in struggle with another smaller figure, that of a boy. But the presence you feel is all about you now, and with a lifting of the hairs at the nape of your neck, you are certain, certain that you are being watched. You turn slowly, half dreading what you might see. But the path before you is empty. Your gaze moves to the great moon-washed face of the house itself. The windows are blank and shuttered, though that strange sixth sense is insisting on hints, whispers, secrets. The scene fades, and you realise that the moon is going back behind the clouds, and then you run. And as you run through the disappearing garden, you feel that a mighty wind is blowing and voices are clamouring in that empty place. What you also hear, and what you will remember ever afterwards with a shudder, even in the full light of day, is the lonely sobbing of a child. To investigate the lonely sobbing, turn to page 46. To inspect the moon dial, turn to page 4.
Yeah.
And the book doesn't use second person again. It's just for this enigmatic prologue.
I really like that, starting with the senses, though, and then introducing the sixth sense.
It's very cool. It's really cool. It really draws you in as well.
So the protagonist of the book is Araminta, known as Minty Kane. it kind of sounds like a joke name, but that is her name. Who has always known that she has senses beyond the ordinary. But she only starts getting sort of really strange experiences when she gets sent to stay with her Aunt Mary in the shadow of a former manor house. It's supposed to just be a holiday, but on the way back from dropping Minty off in the village of Belton, her mother's car is hit and she's left in a coma. So Minty is left with Aunt Mary, who isn't actually her aunt, but her mother's godmother, and kind of essentially a stranger to her.
Can I quickly read the Minty's experience upon hearing about her mum's accident?
Hmm.
Just because I think it's a remarkable stretch of writing.
Hmm.
Thanks. It's Kate. It's your mother. There's been an accident. What followed then, Minty could hardly remember. It all seemed very slow and strange. An eternity passed. And then she actually heard her own voice screaming. It went out of her and froze in the air until it was followed by another scream. And another. And as she stared, it seemed that Aunt Mary's head had swollen like a balloon and was suspended crazily in air, red and monstrous. Then Minty felt her whole body go into a violent shuddering, and now she seemed to be laughing. Hands came down heavily onto her shoulders, and she was being shaken. She was being swallowed, and fought to escape. She tugged herself free, and a sharp blow on her cheek made her gasp with shock and pain. The palm of a hand struck her other cheek, and she drew a long, juddering breath, and was silent.
Mm.
And it was at that point I thought, yeah, this book has some proper children's horror stones. Because, it's really horrifying. I find it quite upsetting, to be honest, that bit.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't expecting her mother to be struck down. As we'd already learned that her father was dead.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, okay, well... That's how it goes for a children's novel protagonist. But then and her mother was Scott as well. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then her hearing herself screaming and screaming and then laughing maniacally and this sensation of being swallowed until she's like being slapped across the face. Mm. I found it really startling.
Yeah, I like that willingness to go weird in the kind of some subjective experience of something.
Yeah, I think that's really impressive about this book, and that's really early on, right? Like, it's quite willing to potentially disorient the reader. Like, you know, it doesn't hold you by the hand at all.
Yeah. So, Aunt Mary sort of is kind of trying to keep her occupied, I guess, and tells her to go and talk to a man called World, who sort of works in the grounds or in the house. And as soon as he sees her, he tells her that she's the one who's come to turn the key and free the children. And then she keeps exploring and she finds the moon dial, and I'll read the bit where she first sees the moon dial. Minty stopped in front of the statue with icy tides washing her from head to foot. There were an old man and a young boy, both winged like angels, although she was certain that they were not. They seemed to be wrestling, struggling for possession of a bowl above their heads. And catching a glimpse of a metal beak, Minty suddenly realised what it was. A sundial, she exclaimed softly, and then, almost immediately and without knowing why, moondial. And as she spoke the word, a cold, distinct wind rushed past her, and the whole garden stirred, and her ears were filled with a thousand urgent voices. She stood swaying. She put her hands over her ears and shut her eyes tight. And that's kind of... sort of what happens when she goes near the moon dial is things go strange and impressionistic. And shortly after finding the moon dial, she meets a dishevelled boy who introduces himself as Tom, short for Edward, And they both accuse each other of being ghosts. He's obviously from a previous era of the house and has a horrible racking cough, but dreams of being 6 foot tall and a footman. Minty, in this first encounter, sees him sort of being cuffed around the head by a gardener and tries to help, but as she sort of drums her fists on the kind of leather jacket of this this gardener, both both him and Tom disappear.
I like the fact that the book lingers a lot on the subjectivity of ghosthood, and that they are each ghosts to each other. I think often, you know, ghosts are always like the other, right? And it's a mysterious unknown. Whereas here, being a ghost is very much in the eye of the beholder, because, you know, they're both kind of out of time, or, yeah, more out of time than out of place. So out of time at different points. So, you know, that they are both ghosts. A ghost is just, in this telling, a person or a being who is out of time, either in the future or the past.
Yeah.
I like that, because normally you have the idea of the ghost being dead, whereas I think the sense of time in this book is that all time is almost unfolding simultaneously. It's like maybe multiple
presents. And they slide into different times through the moon dial, sort of around the moon dial, and like kind of Minty can kind of orient herself by looking at the house and like the chimneys on it, and if the chimneys are smoking, because in her time it's not an inhabited house, it's a show house, but it's also oddly kind of, I guess, because it's preserved as a sort of museum sort of thing, it doesn't look as distinct from 200 or 100 years ago.
And there are some reflections. I mean, it is very much a book about time and the subjective experience of time, and there's reflections and things like audio recording, and how weird that is, that you can kind of freeze a moment, and maybe the kind of wrongness or just the strangeness of that, photography as well. Like, I'm not quite sure what Helen Cresswell's kind of stance on time is, but it seems like she seems very wary of anything that tries to tie down time. Like, there's this wariness about watches and clocks as well. And I like the fact that the ghosts and the hauntings, they're not linear, they're not one directional. It's like Tom and Minty haunt each other. You know, they're both ghosts to each other. So it's much more reciprocal. So there's very kind of generous reciprocal circular conception of time. Like, I can't quite put it into words, because there's some quite odd stuff going on, but I definitely found it really interesting.
Minty's sort of freeing them, Tom and Sarah, somehow. We don't really know, we never really learn how she's doing that, or sort of what are they. We don't sort of get explicitly told that they're trapped, you know, they're ghosts because they're, you know, they've been unhappy children or something. It's just that.
Well, yeah, because they're not necessarily, because she goes back in time to see Tom, and she experiences him as a ghost in his own time. Like, so that's why that's very strange.
It's all quite peculiar.
And like you were saying, that like she has this kind of, it's got this kind of mission-based narrative in the way that, say, with Coraline, right, Coraline has to free the ghost children, but that's quite clear, right? Okay, the Beldam has trapped the ghost children, she's stolen their souls and sewn buttons into their eyes. So she needs to collect these trinkets. I can't remember, she's got to collect the stones or whatever it is, and then she frees the children and they're released from the Beldam. Okay, that's really clear, like, what her objective is. And Coraline was adapted into a video game, and because, you know, you've got clear objectives. Whereas, like, with Moondial, what's really odd is that, like, that objective is really abstracted. So the stakes do feel high. It's a very tense book in places, but you're never quite sure why the stakes are high, because you're not really sure. You know, there's a sense of, you know, sinisterness and bad things will happen. But you don't really know quite exactly what.
Yeah, and how exactly can she free them apart from, like, taking them out of their own time, or taking them out of time? I don't know.
Yeah, like yeah. where's she freeing them to? Like, yeah, but that's the interesting thing about the book is, like, you just have to kind of go with it, like, in these kind of weird metaphysical, I don't know, assumptions. Like, it's hard because it makes you sound quite inarticulate trying to describe it, but it's a very odd book.
We've mentioned Sarah, but Minty finds Sarah, sort of, Sarah's like another kind of 100 years older than Tom, and she's the singing child, singing this mournful song. Poor Mary sits a weeping. I say mournful. The lyrics are mournful. The tune is actually quite jaunty.
can you sing it at all? Because I don't.
I
genuinely don't know it.
Poor Mary sits a weeping. Poor Mary sits a weeping. Warm summer's dead.
Oh, thank you. That does sound quite nice.
Yeah, there's worse times to be weeping. I don't know if that's the only tune it's ever sung to, but that's what I found on YouTube. but yeah, and this girl has her face hidden by a hood, and the sort of the first time Minty sees her, the girl is called away by a voice who accuses her of frightening away the moon. It's particularly harsh. She sort of, when she meets Tom again, he says that he's also seen her, Sarah, and so she's like their ghost in common. They're less contended ghosts, because she's in the past to both of them.
Yeah, and she's sort of tormented by these really cruel neighbour children, I guess, like children of the local area, kind of torment her and call her a devil.
So yeah, there's a couple of separate occasions where they turn up in Sarah's time, and Sarah's being menaced by other children with sacks over their heads, kind of calling her a devil's child, and again, sort of on Halloween by children dressed up as devils, and that's sort of devils, the climax of the book there, but that's kind of, whenever they come across Sarah, she's being tormented or browbeaten or scolded and repeatedly told that she's of the devil. And they kind of, eventually they learn the why this is happening. So they see her on a kind of, on a midsummer day, like trying to do a ritual in a pool and kind of washing her face in this pool because she thinks that that will cleanse her or cure her. And they see that she has a birthmark on one of her cheeks, and that's the reason for all of her, for everyone's calling her a devil. I think there's an interesting thing with a sort of interesting subtle thing with kind of Minty and Tom's kind of differing reactions to this, in the of Tom being of an earlier time and being more convinced of devils and that she might, that, you know, even though also kind of Tom being quite conflicted because he is on Sarah's side, but also he's quite frightened by the idea of devils.
I thought that was neatly done, and I like the fact that with both of these kind of horror climaxes, you have this interesting switch where the ghosts, in as much as in these sequences Tom and Minty are the ghosts, since they're the humans who are out of time and so are appearing to the people and the kids of 200 years ago to be ghosts, are, you know, are sympathetic saviours, whereas the children with their sackcloth masks on are really the sources of horror, even though they're not supernatural at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, the kind of setup of kids being visited by ghosts in the graveyard is completely switched round, whereas it's the ghosts who are the sympathetic points of identification, and these kids who are behaving in a horrible way.
Yeah.
Have you got pictures in your edition? Yeah, because I've the picture in mine of the kids with the sackcloth masks is quite scary.
Yeah, I noticed that. It's quite horrible. It reminded me a bit of of that deranged bit in one of the Deptford Mice with the mouse skins.
Oh no!
Sorry.
Oh god, I've forgotten about that. That was awful. I forget. I think I've repressed quite how horrible the Deptford Mice gets at times. Yeah, that was horrific.
Yeah. So, like, if you're a listener and you're like listening to this and you're like, well, maybe this isn't horrible enough for me, just like go back and listen to our series on the Deptford Mice books, and you'll fill your boots with.
Yeah, frickin' heck. they really, really go very far, those books.
Yeah,
if you feel like a main character's fatherless main character's mum getting in a car accident isn't grim enough, you know, read the freaking Deptford Mice, where everything you know and love will be destroyed.
Preferably in the most gruesome way possible.
Yeah.
And then the author will gloat about being a mouse killer on Twitter.
I mean, there is a sort of villain of sorts,
yes,
in this book.
Yeah, so we have Miss Raven, who, as I said, really does feel like quite a type, who maybe a bit, I don't know, maybe a little out of place. What do you think?
A little, although that makes her more imposing, I think, the fact that she does feel out of place.
I mean, actually,
but yeah, she does feel like...
Actually, I guess it is kind of suggested that maybe she is also a time traveller, potentially. So,
Yeah, she might be a time traveling ghost killer witch or something.
Yeah. But yeah, this is a, she comes to stay with Aunt Mary because she's writing a book about ghosts. And she's this kind of very sort of stern, laced up child-hating kind of evil governess kind of figure. She's mostly off on her own pursuits, but she's also there to sabotage Minty.
Because we don't know, because the book's kept, even though it's third person, it's kept so close to Minty's perspective. You know, it might just be that Minty's really taken against
her. Yeah, that's true.
There's very little evidence that actually she is doing anything harmful apart from researching a book.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about Minty. I mean, she's a really fun, enjoyable protagonist, but she's very, she takes against people, or she really loves people. Mm-hmm. Like, if she loves people, she'll tell them she loves them and really adore them. And if she, dislikes them, she'll just be outright really rude to them.
She's a very she's a good protagonist. She some fun observations from Minty, particularly about how adults talk to children, and Aunt Mary, when he says, I'm sure there's some other children over there at the house, and Minty's just like, well, why do adults always think that any children will just get on immediately?
I think Cresswell does a good job at kind of getting into the mindset of a child. Like, a lot of that was really convincing.
The other sort of odd thing about Miss Raven is that when Tom and Minty kind of slip into Sarah's time and kind of see the woman who's been sort of charged with not looking after Sarah but keeping her contained, I guess. Minty thinks that she's the spitting image of Miss Raven. But we don't know if that's we don't get any more than that.
The thing, like, the books, Cresswell's very happy to keep things ambiguous. Which I think is what marks it out. I think that marks it out from more modern young adult fiction. Which I do still, have a lot of time for. I think there's a lot of good stuff that comes out. But I think, and maybe it's the impact of books like, The Hunger Games and the Maze Runner series and Divergent and how successful they've all been. And they're all very mission-based and objective-based. Mm-hmm. That they have a lot of clarity in terms of how they're written, but also in terms of just the world, I guess, and the world building and how things work. Mm. Whereas there's a kind of fogginess to Moondial that I don't think is very fashionable now. I guess that's what I was saying when I said that it's impressionistic. Mm-hmm. And say with The Hunger Games, it has many, it has many, many positive traits. Mm. I do like those books, but they're not impressionistic.
I keep just wanting to sort of read out quotes from it because there's just so many kind of lovely turns of phrase and descriptions. It's got one just of the graveyard. It says, The graveyard itself was sunlit, owlless. She gazed at the headstones, barnacled and tipsy as if washed up by the tide. She walked intently as any beachcomber on the high and dry line of the shore. The little icy tongues of wind licked her face by the corner of the tower. They were a consolation, a sign that things were not as they seemed. Just like, it's lovely.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Oh, I was just going to say, do any of these... Okay, I'm very aware. I'm very sorry about this, listeners. It's played in my mind over the last month that we failed to do Texture of the Week last episode.
Did we?
Yeah, I had to put it in ad hoc. Like, in my editing, I had to like be like, oh, yeah, and here's Texture of the Week, because we didn't
what?
Do it. Yeah, I know.
Oh,
my
God.
We slipped. We goofed. We done goofed.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was just wondering if any of those snippets you've got qualify for a Texture of the Week, because I'm not missing it again for a second
time. Okay, all right.
I couldn't forgive myself.
All right, shall we?
Right. Yeah, I've got a shaker. Okay.
I've got a handful of paintbrushes.
Great. Okay, texture.
Texture
of the week. Cool, that was quite jaunty, I think.
I mean, I have quite a lot of contenders, but the first one I wanted to mention was the footman's lumpy calves.
Okay, well,
you describe the footman's lumpy calves then, and I'll say something
well,
else.
Well, they're like lumpy porridge. Yeah. I really like that we both chose that, though. What a horrible texture for us both to enjoy.
Yeah, unanimous texture.
Calves like lumpy porridge.
This is in Tom's time. The footman has been padding his calves as after the fashion, but has done a poor job of it. it's just brilliant. The rare unanimous texture. I'll give my
God, that must be like the second or third time. It doesn't often happen.
No. but I'll give an honourable mention to the description of Minty going through, like, shifting between times, how she experiences that. Next moment she was reeling in a long green corridor of time, her ears filled with the odd whispers and voices, and that strong wind blew clean and cold. She was drinking it in and it tasted white in her mouth. She was swimming in it like a fish.
It's just so strange.
Yeah, it's strange and it's simple. It's just really striking. I just really like the writing in this.
I mean, I definitely think in terms of, you know, readers' tastes, like, if you're more interested in well-crafted sentences and atmosphere than you are in conventional plotting, then you really should read this. because it is quite relentless in terms of the quality of the writing. Mm. Like, yeah, there's just so many lovely descriptions.
I also... In terms of bits to read out, I highlighted, maybe you could read this. Minty sort of thinking about the philosophy of the Moondial. Yes.
That is really, really interesting, that bit. I don't know, what page is it on for you?
It starts at the bottom of 113. No.
So then a thought came to her so clearly, that bit. Then a thought came to her so clearly that it was as if a voice spoke. What happened to time? when the moon shines on a sundial. With the question came a cold, distinct draught of air. She had been posed a riddle. "Thank you," she whispered and accepted it. And she walked on while her mind reeled with the enormity of the question. Moondial, measuring a different time. Moondial, free from the slow, relentless march of the sun, the trickle of the sand in the glass, the minute-by-minute ticking of clocks. Moondial, freewheeling, measuring the real time of hearts and lives and linking them across centuries. Moon time.
It's just really interesting. The idea of this other kind of time, and that it's sort of come to her, or maybe the moon dial itself has posed it, has presented itself to her, and she's realizing, like discovering a whole new different form of time. I don't know. It's weird and cool.
Yeah, it is weird and cool. It's quite revelatory. Yeah. Like, it's so easy to get bound to this rational clock time, and to think that that is time and forget how weird time is. I remember when I was doing my PhD and reading about Czech communism, being really caught by the idea of charismatic time. And that under Stalinism, there's this notion that with the five-year plans, that the five-year plans could be compressed into 4 years. And it's like, it's not just about the workers being really fast and efficient. It was like, no, the workers were meant to be so imbued with the spirit of communism that they would literally compress time.
Wow.
Yeah, the will of the worker was greater than the clock. Which is wild, but it's quite a kind of boggling idea if you decide, right, I'm going to try to take this seriously. Yeah, I read a lot of Henri Lefebvre, or Lefebvre. I'm not very good at. I often read things, and then I don't know how you're meant to pronounce.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm sorry for you doing the transcription there. Future N. But yeah, who talks a lot about the idea of rhythms, right? And everything having its own time. And definitely when you look at the natural world, or what we call the natural world, it sort of starts to make a bit of sense. So, you know, you can look at a tree and say, okay, well, I could see how maybe the budding, you know, the budding of the flowers has its own times, and maybe the roots in the soil have their own time, and the clouds have their own time. It's so hard to kind of get outside of, like, the human experience of time and, like, decouple yourself from that. But I think the book does a pretty good job, to be fair.
Yeah. And it links cats to moon time, explicitly. It's cats living on in this different form of time.
Which is another link to Coraline, actually.
Yeah.
It's quite a Neil Gaiman-y thing, the idea of cats being of a kind of different dimension on some level.
There is you know, some plot happens at the end, you know. Tom and Minty, you know, after seeing how Sarah's being treated, you know, agree that they need to rescue her. We learn that Tom isn't actually called Tom, he's actually Teddy, yeah. His name is actually Edward. He's Teddy Larkin. And but all the kitchen boys in the house are called Tom as a shorthand. This is where it's Halloween and sort of, and Sarah tries to do her kind of face cleansing ritual again, but she's surrounded by these masked figures who chant devil's child at her, but and Tom and Sarah scare them off, and Minty uses has a talisman, which is a mirror, and she sort of coaxes Sarah to look at her own reflection and realize that she's beautiful. She's not a devil's child. And when Miss Vol, Sarah's captor, comes tearing up the path after them, Minty lifts up the mirror and says, "Where the devil, where the evil eye?" And sort of everything kind of collapses into a sort of dreamlike state where Miss Vol kind of dissolves into a crumple of black clothes, and we sort of see, and Tom or Teddy and Sarah and Tom's sister, little sister Dory, who he keeps talking about, kind of running away and arm in arm into the mist.
Heaven knows how they did that in the TV adaptation.
Yeah, we will see, because I think we should.
Yeah,
we will talk about it at some point when we can get our hands on it.
Yeah, when we can legally source it at a cheap price.
Yeah, that's the goal. It's sort of one of those weirdly expensive DVDs. And sort of the thing we haven't mentioned is that during this, as this has been going on, Minty has been recording tapes for her mother in hospital, who's still in a coma, but she's, got a cassette player and headphones, and she's instructed the nurse to let her mother sort of listen to these tapes to hear Minty's voice, and at the end sort of Kate comes round and Minty goes to see the Moondial for the last time, and she finds the tiny headstone in the graveyard. It's just marked EL, and realizes that it was Tom's. Yeah. And that's sort of where we end. The last two words of the book are full circle, which does say something about the odd circularity of time in this book.
Yeah, and the Moondial itself is a kind of allegorical sculpture of I think it's Eros, like Cupid, and is it Cronus?
Yeah.
Time, wrestling. So a sort of allegorical depiction of time and love wrestling, and Minty declares that she's on the side of love over time. Which, sounds like the kind of topic for a kind of 80s power ballad. Really, but it's quite an abstract theme.
Yeah.
But the novel takes very seriously. I think like love overcoming time.
It's a very thoughtful book.
I would argue that's pretty much the central theme of Twin Peaks: The Return.
Yeah.
For all of you David Lynch fans out there, so the fact that a 1980s children's book is dealing with the same heady metaphysical themes as David Lynch's sort of swan song magnum opus. And, yeah, definitely says something about how ambitious this book is.
Yeah. And I guess we'll see once we when we watch the TV series how much of the sort of philosophy of it is present in that, and if it becomes more of a straightforward romp.
I mean, I feel like it must do, but it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see. And it does make me want to read more Helen Creswell.
Yeah.
Because it's a really interesting book.
Yeah.
And yeah, not the kind of thing that I think really gets published anymore.
Yeah. I haven't seen anything like it in children's books. Yeah, which I think we've mentioned a few times of sort of when we've read sort of older books of been more slow and meandering and atmospheric and than modern ones.
Yeah, I mean, I do enjoy that myself. Although I will admit that I think as a child, this would have probably been a bit lost on me. I don't know what I would have made of it. I think I would have, like, just been confused by it, if I'm honest.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't...
What about, do you reckon you would have liked it as a kid?
I really don't know. I think I'd have enjoyed elements of it. Like, I think Tom's a pretty memorable character, and Minty's they're good characters to latch onto. But I don't know if I'd have just been mystified by the. I feel like the stuff with Sarah. If you read that as a kid, that's the kind of thing that would stick in your head of this child being mistreated and called a monster and a devil's child. Mm. You know, I think that'd be pretty haunted.
That's true.
That'd be pretty haunting.
Yeah, that is true, actually. I agree with that. I don't want to just delay the end of the episode because I have not thought of a sign-off at all. I've got nothing here.
Well, it's been so long. I've forgotten how to do the outro.
Well, that's good. It'll take you longer until I've got longer to try to think of a sign off.
Thank you for listening. We are sort of still on Twitter as long as Twitter lasts, I guess. Kind of on Instagram. I don't know. I don't know if I want to be on Instagram at all, even personally, let alone as a podcast. So, don't know. We do have an email. That is stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. And we do check it sometimes. So,
yeah, like, it's not our fault that social media is a bad thing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And in fact, you know, if you send us an email, I might not get back to you very swiftly, but we will appreciate it when we do read it and it's not like a weird spam. So that's our promise. That is our promise. our intro is by Maki Yamazaki. Outro is by Joe Kelly. Artwork's by Letty Wilson. And you can, if you wish, write a review or rate us on Apple Podcasts or whatever. sorry, was that unreasonably sassy?
I just enjoy it.
I'm trying to buy you some more time.
No, it's fine. Yeah, you know, not every sign off needs to be witty or funny.
No, this time it just needs to be beautiful and elegaic.
Oh, great. Okay, well, I'll say sleep well, creepy kids, and keep the time of your hearts by the moon dial.
Yes, very good. Thank you, Ed. And
yeah, we'll pretend that's deep. Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Bye.